This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, hi, everyone. My name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a host at the New Book Network, and the channel that I host for is the Sex Work and Sexualities channel. Today, I'm really excited to speak to Kanika Batcha about her amazing book, Worlding Postcolonial Sexualities. Kanika, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Can you tell us who you are and about your area of research?
Certainly. Thank you, Rachel, for this podcast, and thank you to New Books as well. I am professor of English at Texas Tech University, where I teach courses in postcolonial studies, comparative literature, gender and sexuality studies, particularly courses in transnational feminism and queer studies. And before joining Texas Tech, I was an assistant professor at the University of Delhi, where I was trained primarily in British literature, but also secondarily during my graduate studies in comparative literature and feminist studies. I did my bachelor's and master's and my MPhil from the University of Delhi. Mm. And then I went to Loyola University, Chicago for my PhD, where I specialized in postcolonial studies and where I also taught very briefly courses on South Asian studies. So, in short, my primary specializations are postcolonial and comparative literature, and also strongly connected to these is my interest in women's and gender studies. And in my work, what I try to do is explore the intersections between these various modes of analysis so as to come up with a methodology for examining literary and cultural production as also social movement literature from these various locations that I am interested in, primarily locations in the global south. And for purposes of this book, Worlding Postcolonial Sexualities, my contexts are India, Jamaica, and South Africa. In the past, I have written on postcolonial drama, again, in connection with feminist and queer consciousness emerging from Global South locations. And this book is kind of like a continuation of that work with a slightly different focus. My previous work was more literature focused, literary, so to speak. Whereas this current work that we're talking about today, it delves into social movement literature, what I like to call activist literature, literature which is not literary in the strict sense of the term, but it is the kind of reading material, the kind of material which carries a movement forward, magazines, journals, newspapers, newsletters, pamphlets, manifestos, etc.
Yeah, I mean, they're really important. They're really important documents. They're historical documents, aren't they? They're just not formalized. So in your introduction, you describe using the post-colonial feminist and queer archives for alternative histories of sexual precarity, vulnerability, and resistance. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yes. First, I think I would like to go into the definition of the archives, which has expanded greatly over the past couple of decades. You know, when we talk about archives today, we usually think of not just materials tucked away in dusty libraries where, you know, people have to make special trips and find them, but also materials which were previously tucked away in these spaces, but which have increasingly now become digitized.
Mm.
Right? And so the definition of the archives has kind of shifted over the past few decades with increasing technological affordances, right? So some of this work that I did involve visiting libraries and archival centers and special collections and contacting individuals who may have had access to some of these materials, maybe because they were involved directly in some of the social movements that I'm studying. But a large portion of the material that I looked at is also available online, you know. So I would say it's sort of half and half. About 50% of the materials I accessed by going to special collections and libraries, and about half of the material I accessed was available online. Okay. It became available online during the process of writing the book. So these archives, whether digital or print, what they are doing is recording a certain movement or certain movements during a certain period of time, which in my case, the focus is 1970s to 1990s. This is the pre-digital era, so to speak, right? So at that point of time, activists, particularly activists working in the women's movement or in the incipient gay, lesbian, and queer movements, they really did not have the means of communication which are available to us today. Social media, listservs, Twitter feeds, and so on. You know, all that was not available at that point of time. So these publications were really the primary means of communication available to them. And these were, for the most part, independent publications. You know, they did not rely on governmental sources of funding. They were published by non-governmental organizations which were working in the fields of women's empowerment and gay and lesbian rights, broadly the rubric human rights. And what they did at this point of time from the 1970s to the 90s is sort of create a public which was interested in these events and these discussions about broadly human rights issues affecting women and gay and lesbian populations. But they also, shall we say, brought this broad public or community of readers into being. Because previously in these contexts, there were no publications which were catering to a readership which was marginalized, vulnerable, facing discrimination, and really did not have the social means of communication that we now have, thanks to technology, available to them. Mm. Right? For all, in most cases, the materials that I'm looking at are pioneering publications from these various different locations. Let me just give you an example. For instance, Manushi, the magazine from India that I look at. It was an English language magazine which was published by two women academics who were both working at the University of Delhi. And they decided early on that they were not going to be accepting any kind of donor funding or governmental funding to bring out a magazine which talked about the rights of women. The magazine also came into being because the 1970s, late 1970s, early 80s, was a period which on the one hand in India was marked by increasing attention to violence against women, but also increasing governmental regulation to try and prevent instances of violence against women, right? So this was a pioneering magazine which was trying to cover a lot of ground by documenting cases of violence, by documenting legal recourses women had at their disposal to combat this violence, by connecting women's issues to broader working class issues, by making sure that this magazine was not just covering incidents of gloom and doom, but it was also an outlet for creativity. There was poetry in the magazine, there were stories in the magazine, there were translated pieces of writing in the magazine, translated from various Indian languages. Right? Now, similarly, around the same time, in Jamaica, a small group of women who ran a theater group called Sistrin Theater Collective, they brought out a magazine called Sistrin Magazine. Initially, the magazine was to communicate to their Jamaican and Caribbean readers the activities that the theater group was involved in. But very soon, the magazine moved beyond that. And again, like Manushi in the Indian context, started documenting instances of violence and abuse, but also documenting the various rights and legal recourses women had to combat that violence. Started talking about community education, started talking about women working in non-traditional jobs, like construction, farming, which was traditionally considered a male occupation, but within Jamaica, there is a preponderance of women working in farming activities. So all of these publications, much like the ones I've talked about, the two I've talked about are Sistrin Magazine and Manushi. All of these publications are documenting sexual precarity in many ways. The kind of violence which women and sexual minorities are exposed to in many of these locations. But then they are not just stopping there. They're also making sure that the readers have knowledge and awareness of their own rights and legislation about these rights, of what they can do to protect themselves. And so these are definitely archives of a certain era.
Yeah. But also as well, that milieu at the time, that's an era of like really kind of like heightened political awareness and political activity. Because I'm thinking, the 70s, we don't know in the 70s, the beginning of the 70s, the civil rights movement has been squashed. Yeah, we're still optimistic. Yeah, it's a really important period, isn't it? It's before that sort of it's before the internet, it's before that mass sort of media control, you know. And I was, reading about that period, it actually made me a bit nostalgic because I remember, and it's not quite the same, but it's sort of similar. I remember sort of like, because obviously I was quite young at the time, but I was still like, engaged. And, I remember there would be all these like punk magazines, like these little zines and stuff like that. And they would be really important in your community to find out what was going on. And you'd wait for them to come out and they would be in special places and you would go to those places to get the zine. And, it was a community bonding type activity as well as a kind of like an historical document. So yeah, I sort of that made me, I was really aware of that. I was very conscious of the time period, it made me quite nostalgic. So can you tell me why you chose India, Jamaica, and South Africa?
So I think I was looking for was contexts where there was some documentation of second and third wave feminist concerns, but also how these connected to an emerging queer rights discourse. Okay. And what I found was uncanny similarities between these contexts. Mm. let me again give an example and say that, you know, Jamaica, usually considered one of the most homophobic countries in the world, right? One hears so much about violence against gay, lesbian, and queer people in Jamaica. However, from the late 70s onwards, what people don't realize is that there was also a burgeoning gay and lesbian consciousness, which is documented in one of the magazines of this period, which was circulated privately. It was not for public consumption. It was circulated privately and rather secretively among the gay and lesbian population in Jamaica, but also the gay and lesbian population in the wider Caribbean. It also reached the Jamaican and Caribbean diasporic population in the US and UK. And so this emerging consciousness, I think, then sort of allows us to reevaluate the notion of Jamaica as a homophobic space. Mm. And so we can't just hold on to that notion. We can actually say, well, Jamaica also was the site of a emerging gay and lesbian consciousness. Similar things were happening in other parts of the world. Again, in the late 70s, early 80s in South Africa, there was an organization called the Gay Association of South Africa. You know, it was predominantly a white organization. They were not really known for their progressive racial politics. But nevertheless, what they were trying to do is sort of create a community for the gay and lesbian population in primarily in Johannesburg, but then they had branches all over South Africa, in Cape Town and other locations in South Africa later on. And again, you know, India kind of steps in a little later than these early examples of global South gay and lesbian emergence, because the first regularly run magazine for gay and lesbians in India did not originate till 1990.
Okay.
Not to say that there was not gay and lesbian emergence before that. There certainly was, but we don't have documents of that emergence. So what I was seeing was these sort of overlapping trajectories in feminist movements, but also in gay and lesbian movements, emerging gay and lesbian movements. And so, you know, my interest as a post-colonialist is in the Global South.
Yeah.
So these three contexts offered me rich sites for analyzing those connections. And what it allowed me to do was also to see if these movements were in fact speaking to each other or not. And in fact, they were, because Indian feminists were in touch with Caribbean feminists and with African feminists.
Yeah.
And Indian gay and lesbian activists were aware of other gay and lesbian movements in other parts of the Global South.
Yeah.
So for me, I think it was simply a matter of Global South connections and linking these contexts together.
Yeah, because what I got from it as well is like, These are all like sort of former colonized by Britain places, aren't they? And I thought that was quite interesting, because what I really got a sense of as well, this kind of overthrowing of the kind of sort of like post-colonial sort of adaptation. So I'm a criminologist, so I can tend to come at things slightly differently, you know, but I do know that in Jamaica, like practically, you know, one of the first laws that got put down after emancipation from Britain was this kind of like, you know, these anti-buggery laws, because the way buggery had been used as a way of controlling people. Yeah. And so it was really interesting to see how that, you know, you identify Jamaica as being a space that we're told is like massively homophobic, but actually is a space of a lot of resistance, historically resistant. I was really interested in why you didn't use Trinidad though, because I thought Trinidad would have been a really interesting sort of like comparison, like almost between Jamaica and India, because there's that massive Asian diasporic population there. That would have been really quite interesting, I would thought.
Yeah, Trinidad would have been a great case study too. I think my primary reason for using these three contexts was that there was some archivization of the social movements that I'm studying in these three contexts that I could access, you know, and I was not sure about the archivization available in contexts like Trinidad.
Yeah,
right? Yeah. Trinidad would be a good fit because, you know, they, again, a formerly colonized country.
Yeah.
Under British colonialism, inheriting some of the anti-homosexuality legislation that was certainly the case in South Africa, India, and Jamaica. And that continues to be the case.
Yeah.
In some respects, in Jamaica, certainly, right?
Yeah.
So the point of connection that you charted between these three contexts that I study is the legacy of colonial legislation. You know? And that is very much true of Trinidad as much as it is of Jamaica.
Yeah. But I would say even probably even more because you've got that kind of that indentured like Asian sort of diasporic population that comes in. I read a phrase in your book that really jumped out to me, so I really wanted you to explain it to me because I was quite interested. You use a phrase, research on an international scale above the nation state and below the world system. How does the book do this? How does the book explain this? What does the book do with this?
This is a kind of a disciplinary siloization that I'm working against. It does not always happen, but sometimes it does happen that people who work in postcolonial studies often often end up concentrating on one geographic area.
Okay.
You know, which is, it could be either South Asia or they could be Africanists or they could be Caribbeanists. And I think because of my background in comparative literary studies, what I'm trying to do here is both push against the centrality of the nation state as an explanatory paradigm, but also against the centrality of region-specific analyses.
Mm.
So that I'm trying to do is say, okay, these are very vast regions. Africa is not just one country, it is several countries. So in South Asia as a region, again, a vast territory. Then also the Caribbean, many different small nation states, right? So maybe it's not possible to look at these regional contexts in entirety to be able to do justice to the discourse which is emerging about the women's movement or the gay and lesbian movement. But maybe it is possible to use the national trajectories as launching pads and then to talk about regional and global south cross currents,
yeah,
which are occurring. So again, a couple of examples I think would be helpful here. I'm thinking, for instance, of a Global South collective called Development Alternatives for Women in a New Era. And the acronym is DAWN. And that collective was, in fact, initiated by some Indian feminist economists. And what it went on to do then was emerge as a think tank for Global South discussions about women and development.
Hmm.
With the inputs of Caribbean feminists, African feminists, as well as South Asian feminists, right? And I think the thinking there was that development issues which are particularly relevant to the Global South, they cannot be addressed from a Euro-American perspective. No matter that the hegemony of the Euro-American perspective is center stage in international or shall we say global discussions, right? So that we do need to keep an eye on the international or the global discussions, but that we need to develop our own paradigms for analysis.
Yeah.
These are above the nation state, yet below the global international hegemonic arena.
Yeah. You use the phrase south to south, and I really
south like to that. South, yeah. And that's what it is. These are south-south cooperations. And then these feminists then became really, really strong voices in the United Nations conferences on women and development. United Nations conferences through the 90s, 80s, 90s, and then till the present.
Yes.
And then what they did was they combined initially at the United Nations forums, there was some hesitation bringing concerns of sexual minorities on board in those discussions. But thanks to the efforts of some of these pioneering feminists, those discussions were brought onto the global arena through the United Nations, because the logic which was propounded was, you know, these are all social justice issues. These are all development issues. One cannot talk about women's development without talking about concerns of sexual minorities. So there is now a growing awareness of the intersectionality of these concerns, thanks in part to many of these early Global South pioneers, or shall we say South-South cooperation.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. You argue that worlding sexualities involves considering feminist and LGBTQ publications as anterior center publications. So what do you mean by this, and how does the book explore this?
Yes. So you were talking a while ago, Rachel, about countercultural publications, right?
Yeah.
With respect to those punk magazines and other countercultural forms of expression which were available in the 70s, probably the early 80s as well. So the phrase I use is counterpublics, which is not my phrase. It is a phrase which has been used very effectively by feminists and queer theorists. And it is basically, as it is defined by the philosopher, feminist philosopher Nancy Fraser, it is a parallel discourse arena. Counterpublic is a parallel discourse arena. And so if we are looking for discourse or conversations about concerns which are relevant to women and LGBTQ populations, then we cannot look just to mainstream sources.
No.
We cannot look just at mainstream newspapers or mainstream magazines, because they will have some discussion about concerns which are important to these constituencies, but those discussions will be buried among other news or other focuses, right? And so these magazines that I'm looking at, they emerge as counterpublics. Because they provide a front and center stage attention to concerns of sexual violence, legislation impacting women and LGBTQ populations, and the way they become anterior counterpublic is because they kind of initiate that discussion. You know, they are pioneers in initiating that discussion. Before these magazines or these newspapers were published, there was no public discussion, you know, so there was no avenue for talking about these concerns in this focused, directed manner, right? And so anterior in that sense, as venues which are coming first and foremost prior to other discussions, which we now take for granted.
I mean, what I you know, sort of like this phrase that came to me when I was reading this, because what you're getting is an historical echo of an insider viewpoint. It's almost like, you know, an insider viewpoint that you would not have got in the mainstream. Yeah,
right.
You know, even within a mainstream context, even within a sort of like a sort of feminist standpoint context, that standpoint is often from an insider looking into a community.
Right.
you know. So, and that's what I got. It's almost like you've got this echo of these people talking about what's going on for them from their perspective, without actually responding to a question. They're doing their own thing. And that made me realize just how important a resource this type of archival work is, you know, because it is, you know, it's kind of the evidence of how people within a marginalized community were thinking of at the time, without responding to an app, you know, an outsider wanting to ask some questions. It's just how they see things. And it was, you know, it made, you know, that really resonated with me how important this type of methodology is.
Can we, since you brought up the issue of echoes, I want to sort of continue with the sound metaphor and say that there is, yes, there are echoes of the kind of efforts people were involved in to provide more visibility to some of these issues. Yes, there was. But there are also noticeable silences. So that, you know, I don't want listeners of these podcast to think that if these are pioneering gay and lesbian publications or pioneering feminist publications, then all is well with the politics, and we need not examine the politics closely, because we do need to do that, right? We can celebrate these sources, but we must also be critical of these sources when the occasion demands.
Yeah.
And silences which are there are very noticeable. So that initially, the Indian magazine, Indian women's magazine that I'm talking about, it had a distinctly anti-lesbian stand. Mm. And it was not willing to take on lesbian women's concerns on board, you know. Initially, the gay and lesbian publication from South Africa that I look at, which is called Exit, which began its life as a bilingual magazine called Links Kakel, initially it was not just white focused, but also very much gay male focused, right? And so there were a lot of differences of opinion between the gay men and lesbian women who were organized, who were involved in the organizational stuff related to the publication. Mm. Because the lesbian women felt that the gay male point of view articulated in the publication was not taking on board other important social justice concerns of the period. This is the period of anti-apartheid activism, right? And to just have a blinkered white gay male approach to liberation is actually doing a disservice to the movement itself.
Yeah.
So yes, there are echoes. The magazines and the publications and the newspapers are echoing important social concerns, but sometimes they're also noticeably silent on other social concerns. And some of those silences are also the focus of my book. You know, I appreciate these sources for what they offer us, the insights they offer us, but I don't want the readers to be blind about the oversights in these sources as well.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. For over 30 years, Merrick has crafted high-quality dog food. Since our founding in Hereford, Texas, all of Merrick's recipes have prioritized whole nutrition with deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. That's why we say real is our recipe. Real ingredients and homestyle flavors your pet loves. Look for new Merrick packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. Find it online or in your local pet store.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up!
crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato, coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret cane sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
I mean, to an extent as well, that like, and I took on board what you said, there's very little about sort of lesbian women. There's even less about trans folk.
You know? Right.
And so it's almost to the point of, well, it's who's got access to resources, isn't it? And as right. you know, like, sort of like poverty is heavily feminized. So right. I wonder if there's like other sources of like sort of archival type material that we'll come across that will allow us a further insight into sort of like, you know, the issues that lesbian and trans folk faced at the time. I love the way that you've divided the book into like sort of three sections. And you name the sections like beautifully. Can you tell us what the sections are called and why you chose those words? They're beautiful.
Thank you for pointing that out. It was only after I had finished the book that the section titles came to me. I had the organization clear in my head. I knew that it would be sort of divided in two chapters pertaining to each context. But then I also, the more I thought about it, I kind of realized that there were important words from each of these contexts, which kind of summed up what these pioneers were doing. Mm-hmm. So the word that I chose for the Jamaican section is a beng, which is a horn used by the Maroons. The runaway slaves, they used the horn as a sort of a call to arms, you know, against the colonial masters that they were escaping from, right? So it is a rallying call, as it were, you know, but also a means of communication among people who were the original revolutionaries in the Caribbean islands, as it were, right? The second section is titled Azadi. Azadi is, you know, it's from the Urdu word for liberation. And what it really means is again, within the Indian context, what it had always meant was liberation from any form of oppression. Historically, that meant liberation from colonial oppression. But more recently, the queer population has used this phrase and sort of combined it with the word queer and called it queer Azadi, which is a form of interculturalism if you really look at it. You know, queer, not a word from the South Asian context. Azadi, very much a South Asian word, which has a historical legacy attached to it, a legacy of revolution and liberation, much like the abeng horn in the Jamaican context.
Yeah.
And Amandala, which is the third section, is the South African section. Amandala, again, the sort of African National Congress's call for revolution and liberation, the anti-apartheid struggle, which was a revolutionary struggle, and which did lead to certain successes. And South Africa is a test case here because it did decriminalize homosexuality. It did provide equal rights for all sections of the population, regardless of gender and sexual orientation, constitutionally. It did not do it retrospectively. Mm. It too inherited the legacy of colonialism, but that legacy of colonialism was remedied the moment apartheid ended.
Yeah.
And so these three terms, I think, allow me to capture the potential for resistance, as also the connection with these very local indigenous words, with the conversations that these activists were having, which connected to second and third wave feminist and social activism. Some of which was translated over in each of these contexts.
Mm. Yeah, I wondered, like, because I wondered about the South African context, whether it was easier to enshrine in laws sort of like equality because the segregation was so formal. Yeah, it was recognized. Whereas in Jamaica and in India, it's still as segregated, but it's less formally recognized. Yeah, right. So I wondered if it was easier then just to kind of enshrine that into law. So I kind of really wanted to talk again about Jamaica, because you say in the Jamaican context, you talk about the print mediated communication allowed the sort of like New Kingston as a liberationist activist space. How did that happen? Can you talk us through that a little bit?
New Kingston is a mixed bag, as far as I can make out, you know. It was kind of recently developed in the 70s, so it sort of became a space where many of the people who were activists in the gay freedom movement in Jamaica lived and could socialize with each other. Mm. But it is also a very class demarcated space, you know. It is sort of like an affluent section of an American city.
Yeah.
You know, gated communities, shopping malls, hotels, those are located in New Kingston, right? So it remains a very sort of a class segregated space. But what has recently happened is that because the city is so differentiated by income and purchasing potential, it has also, you know, there is a sort of a bleeding in of the elements which New Kingstonians or the upper class Jamaicans would like to keep out of that location. So one of the peculiar things which has happened is that it is the home of impoverished homeless transgender populations now, literally living on the streets or in sort of areas which are in uninhabitable, you know, drains.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the gully queens, so to speak, they are called. And they are, you know, they're there, they're visible, but they are obviously targets of violence, you know, extreme forms of violence, right? And so New Kingston is, one could see it as a space which perhaps due to the social interactions which were facilitated among the people living in that space, perhaps it did lead to a form of queer associationism, right? But also that it kind of it made the people who did not have class privilege especially vulnerable to extreme forms of social violence. And I think that is the case pretty much everywhere in big cities. Now, it is certainly the case in Mumbai or Bombay, as it was previously called. Right, there are these exclusive preserves of affluence and wealth and security, but then there are also areas where people are cruising in public and are susceptible to forms of violence,
yeah.
You know, police extortion. Till recently, when homosexuality was still criminalized, people who are cruising in public spaces in Mumbai are more susceptible to violence than people who are expressing their sexuality and having sexual relations which are technically criminalized in the safety and security of their homes or at private events.
Yeah. Right?
So this is a sad reality everywhere, you know. But it's more exacerbated in global south cities, where extreme wealth and extreme poverty sort of coexist side by side.
Yeah.
You know, which is not to say that if a population is criminalized, that whether the members of that community are extremely rich or extremely poor, they're both susceptible to extortion and abuse.
Yeah. Right?
But the extortion and abuse is often more extreme when the population is impoverished.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you get that in the sort of like the you know, within the global Northwest, in, you know, because the South is in the Northwest as well. And my research around street workers, you know, experiencing extreme levels of violence, you know,
right.
along with homelessness, and quite often like extreme levels of violence from police, you know. That doesn't escape, does it? And it's quite interesting as well to think about, you know, because I was thinking about when South speaks to South, because what really occurred to me as well is, like, again, the timing of this, because I was thinking about how, you know, in the decade before the 70s, like, you know, sort of Malcolm X had been reaching out to Africa and sort of like, you know, sort of like trying to engage as a black man with, you know, wider society, wider sort of like global society. And this is a continuation of that type of thing, isn't it? It's that continuation of people reaching out to each other over the sort of like former colonial sort of powers. But also as well that was kind of, you know, that's echoed as well sort of later when sort of within those kind of like the marginalized communities in sort of like more affluent countries. You know, the support that's got from outside of that. I didn't really articulate that very well, but yeah, I know what I'm saying. So you say in the book, in the coda section of the book, you describe that you learned and continue to learn to be a feminist from the print counter public studied in the book. What do you mean by that? How you learned to be a feminist, how you continue to learn to be a feminist? I thought that was quite interesting and I kind of wanted to explore that with you.
So I think, you know, I was born in the 70s. I was very young when some of these magazines were published in India in the 80s. Mm. Right? And I was probably 10 or 12 years old. Mm. When one day my mother came home excitedly talking about this magazine that somebody had given her a copy of the magazine, she brought it home. She was very excited. She looked through it, and I looked through it as well. I was not so excited, you know. It was all print. There weren't any pictures and anything. So some of these magazines were around the time I was growing up, you know, and I did not have an idea about the importance of these magazines for women a generation older than me. Right? It was only later in the 80s when I went to college, you know, when I was in college, then I realized the kind of, you know, then I heard more about these publications. And I also sort of learned more about campus activism, you know, campus women's activism. And at that point, I think, you know, as a teenager going to college on public transport, I became more aware of the violence which sort of exists in public spaces for young women and for women of all ages, literally, right? And that is when I went back to those back issues of the magazines, which were at my house, which, you know, a few years ago, I didn't find so interesting, but now suddenly I was looking at them with new eyes.
Yeah.
And I realized that, hey, wait a minute, this is, these feminists were talking about these issues, have been talking about these issues for the past 10 years, and now they appear relevant to me because, you know, one encounters as a woman harassment in public spaces, on public transport. One has seen the kind of discriminatory practices against people who look or behave a little differently. You know, I went to a women's college, and there were always, indications that should women students not behave in a decorous manner, there was likely to be repercussions, or warnings, as it were, right? So I think only in the late 80s did I come to realize the importance of some of these discussions via these magazines, that had been, these discussions had been taking place in our home because my mother was sort of aware of these discourses. And I guess in a sense, I also imbibed these discourses, you know, through conversations with her about women's rights, about how best to safeguard myself and my friends against violence should we encounter violence in the public sphere. But the publications were talking about these in an open manner, in a very nuanced, and also unafraid kind of a manner.
Yeah. You know,
I also saw a lot of feminist plays around this time. So that kind of sharpened my sense of the kinds of discussions which could take place outside of those magazines through cultural activism. Street demonstrations were quite common in those days. The connections between these publications and the activism actually emerged much later when I started working on my PhD on postcolonial drama. And I realized that the drama I wanted to study was only interesting to me insofar as it furthered these social movements.
Yeah.
So I continue to learn to be feminist from not just from these publications, but from the cultural manifestations of some of these ways of thinking that these magazines, but also the feminist collectives, which were responsible for these publications and responsible for the cultural activism initiated, right?
Yeah.
I think my consciousness of the connections between feminist concerns and LGBTQ concerns came in the late 1990s, I would say. Well, middle to late 1990s. I was still a student at the University of Delhi, but 1998 is when Deepa Mehta's controversial film Fire was released in India. Mm. And it was the Hindu right wing decided to censor the screening of the film. And that became the moment of emergence for Indian feminists, so to speak, Indian lesbian feminists. There was still very little connection between mainstream feminism and lesbian feminism in India. But that is also the moment of emergence. Okay? That is also the moment when two landmark anthologies, one on gay writing and one on lesbian writing from India came out. And as luck would have it, I was asked to review the anthology on lesbian writing from India by the newspaper Pioneer, which is published from New Delhi. And so the connections between these two seemingly disparate social movements came together for me from the mid 90s to the late 1990s. And, you know, feminism is ever evolving, and LGBTQ activism. So one has to keep on learning how to be a feminist. I don't think there is an achievable sense of being feminist and deciding, okay, I'm feminist in this way and in this way only.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if our feminism is not intersectional, it's nothing.
No, exactly. And I like the way that you use Spivak in your book as well. I've used Spivak in my PhD because, you know, when I was doing my PhD, it forced me to look at how I identified as a feminist. And a lot of the sort of like, you know, because I studied sex work, a lot of the feminists that I would have used before couldn't use. It was, you know, it was not appropriate. We have to totally reinvestigate ourselves every time, don't we? To make sure that we're not taking away voice because of the privileged position that we occupy. Right. Okay. What do you mean that the research materials you examined offer a glimpse of future oriented feminist gender and solidarities? That sounded hopeful. I liked the sound of that. What does that mean?
Well, there is increasing representation of transgender populations in many of these contexts, right? That I study, so that, you know, if, for instance, we do not find trans voices and trans concerns represented in some of the publications that I'm studying in the book. Now, then we have to move beyond these publications and say, okay, is there something happening outside of these publications that these publications are not able to reflect or not able to discuss, precisely because their focus is at that point somewhat narrow, right? And so the emerging concerns for our times are trans concerns, are concerns where we need to keep in mind that there is not just one way of being queer. There are multiple ways of being queer, just as there are multiple ways of being feminist, right? And so if we are thinking of future directions for feminist queer alliances, then one of these would be a direct focus on transgender mainstreaming, so to speak, right? Or should be, at least. And there is recognition of that. I see a change in press representations. And previously, representations of trans lives were sensationalistic, somewhat stereotyped, and could be quite objectionable. Now, I think trans people are hopefully represented with more dignity, with humanity, and with an awareness that, you know, people are people, you know, no matter what their gender might be, and that the choice, within quotes, the choice of gender is really not a free choice as it is made out to be. You know, it is not like wearing one's clothes. You know, one does not choose one's gender in the same way. It is false to see it in that way. And so so I think with respect to the Indian government, I think there is some awareness of these concerns. And so we find increasing representation in employment, in voter registration, which requires people to sort of identify their gender. That has somewhat been changed or is in the process of being changed. And so the future directions that we want to look at, if we want to grow as feminists and as queer activists, should be not just greater representation, but also a greater kind of awareness that feminism is not just for women and queer activism is not just for queer people, that these are ways of looking at the world to transform it.
Yeah, exactly.
In more just ways, in more fair ways.
So who did you write this book for? When you were writing this book, who were you writing this for?
I was writing it primarily for students.
Okay.
Interested in digging deep into the history of feminist and queer studies, secondarily for scholars.
Okay.
Who might be looking for sources, but primarily what I had in mind was that, you know, I had to dig a lot to find some of these sources, and I didn't want students who were interested in excavating queer histories or feminist histories to be able to dig as long as I had to. You know, they if they wanted sources, then I've provided a list of sources, my analysis of those sources, but they don't have to take my word for it.
No, you've just signposted them, haven't you? If it's just
right.
Yeah, it's important. So I have to ask you, like at the very end of the book, you talk about a phone call from someone you call A. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that phone call and what it meant to you.
I'm sorry, say that again.
I said, tell us, at the end of the book, you talk about a phone call that you received from a student, right. A, that you called A. Tell us about the phone call and what it meant to you.
Yeah, so this was, it was just a few months ago. I had already finished the book by then. I was thinking about COVID and how it had impacted, queer populations, women. One had heard a lot and read a lot about the rise in domestic abuse because of the lockdown COVID restrictions, because many of these women found themselves in houses shut up with their abusers, right? For queer people, the social spaces had kind of shrunk as well, because other than social media, there was no safe space for meeting, particularly if the family in which the queer child or the queer young adult was living was already homophobic, then it became a little bit of a problem, right? So I was thinking about some of these issues. I just didn't know how to sort of make sense of them. And then one night, I saw an email from somebody who was A's father, and he wrote to me and he said, I see that you work on queer studies, also on feminist studies. I would like you to talk to my daughter, And this is not the kind of email one receives typically in a day's work, right? It's just that I wrote to him. I said, I'm happy to talk to your daughter, but I'm not sure what advice I can offer. And he says, no, I just want you to reassure her that it's okay to be queer. It's okay to be interested in queer studies. He seemed very supportive of his daughter, And he said, could you send me your WhatsApp number and I'll have her call you on your WhatsApp number. And so I did. And he first called me and talked to me, the father did, and said, can I put you on the phone with my daughter? And he did. And we talked for an hour. And what I realized was that A's immediate family was very supportive, including her father, but her extended family, with whom she was close, because, in India, that's the way it works. The extended family has a say in children's lives and careers, right? And so the extended family was not so supportive, and they were kind of, they were emotionally, I think, without even meaning to, they were kind of torturing her by saying things like, don't bring shame on the family by working on queer stuff, hide your sexuality because we don't really want public shaming, things like that, right? And at the same time, A was doing her, I think, master's or MPhil degree from the University of Delhi. And she went to her professors and talked about working on queer studies. And she was told by some of her teachers that this is not really the space to work on these issues. If you want to work on these, then you should probably apply to a university abroad. And that was a bit shocking to me, because a lot has changed since I have left India, and I have a sense that some of the most vibrant discussions on queer and feminist concerns are emerging from not just from the university, but also from wider South Asia as a region, right? So that was a little shocking. And that, I wanted to reassure her that it's okay for her to stay on in India and work on queer studies if that's what she wants. I also think that there is a bit of a, shall we say, lack of knowledge about the various materials which are available for somebody like A to work on queer studies. Mm. So this book really, if A ever looks at the book, this book should help her, in working towards that goal of researching, studying queer literature and queer culture. I also told her about a bookstore I used to frequent and gave her clear directions on how she could find those books. Although books are now available, queer literature is available pretty much in all bookstores in India.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an important book for as a methodology. It's a really important book. I really enjoyed the book. It made me think, it did what good books do, which made me think, but what else is out there? It also kind of made me think of a book that I reviewed a few months ago with a trans beauty queen from Chile who was living in the States, and how he'd used like archival researches. It was it was really interesting. So finally, what have you got lined up next? What's next on the agenda?
Well, I am thinking of a new project, which is probably going to look at South Africa and the United States, particularly through the perspective of South Africans who were at some point visitors or exiles in the United States. So there is a kind of a deep connection between some of these anti-apartheid writers and thinkers and US civil rights activism. Hmm. And so those are some of the connections that I'm thinking of. I'm thinking in particular of Miriam Makeba, the South African singer who was married to Stokely Carmichael, the power activist. And so it is going to be a project which is going to be about autobiographies, focused on autobiographies. So the way I access these connections between South African anti-apartheid activism and US civil rights activism will be through autobiographies and biographies. So this is a new project. I've just started it. I've sort of submitted one chapter of the project to a journal, but it will take time. It is such a rich area of analysis, but also quite difficult.
Yeah,
because there's a lot of scholarship, which is somewhat outside of my primary training and area of emphasis so far. I am not trained in American literary history or American literary studies or American cultural studies. So I have to acquire that training.
I like this so far. You know, by the time you finish that book, you are going to be well and truly changed. So my name is Dr. Rachel Stewart. I'm a researcher at the University of Kent in the UK. And I have been talking most entertainingly with Kanika Batcha about her book, Worlding Postcolonial Sexualities. Kanika, can you just tell us who's published it, when it was published, and who you are?
The book is published by Routledge, the book was solicited for the Routledge series in Subversive Histories, Feminist Futures. This is a new series, and it is a series Routledge has brought out in collaboration with the National Women's Studies Association. The book is also the winner of the 2020 National Women's Studies Association Routledge Prize in Subversive Histories, Feminist Futures.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us.